Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Cybersecurity experts have been sounding the alarm for two decades, warning that this country's critical infrastructure is vulnerable to attack. Private sector companies own some 85% of that infrastructure. And this month, Colonial Pipeline, whose 5,500-mile pipeline supplies the eastern seaboard with almost half its gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel, made headlines.
On Friday evening, May 7th, Colonial Pipeline reported that its pipeline system had been subject to a ransomware cyber attack.
Growing number of gas stations across the region are shut down entirely.
Anxious drivers racing to fuel up their tanks. The panic buying, of course, only makes...
Some airlines are having to tanker truck in jet fuel. American Airlines has had to reroute two...
It was the arrival of the inevitable. Inevitable because back in 2012, Congress tried to pass a cybersecurity bill that would have regulated privately owned critical infrastructure. Republican Senator Susan Collins co-sponsored the bill.
The cyber threat facing our nation is real and demands immediate action. The time to act is now. We simply cannot afford further delay.
The measure had the support of the highest levels of U.S. national security, including the then heads of the NSA and the Joint Chiefs of Staff and the Obama administration. But it faced strenuous opposition from the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, who condemned the efforts as excessive government interference in the free market. The chamber had also spent more than $66 million in lobbying the previous year. The bill's most vocal opponents were a group of Republicans led by Senator John McCain. They filibustered, and in August 2012, the cybersecurity proposal died. Collins was livid.
It is a shameful day that the Senate did not proceed to act on this bill.
Well, Mark Montgomery is senior advisor to the Cyberspace Solarium Commission. That is a commission that was created in 2019 to develop a strategic approach to defense against major cyber attacks in the United States. And he joins us now. Welcome to On Point.
Thank you for having me, Meghna.
So first of all, back in 2012, you heard that tape from Senator Collins. Was she exaggerating the threat in 2012?
No, she was not. 2012 was an absolute missed opportunity. What Collins Lieberman was advocating for, increased standards in our cybersecurity of our critical infrastructure, was and is important. Ironically, the amendments that Senator McCain was pushing forward on information sharing are also important, but the loss of the bill can't be understated.
Hmm. So then fast forward now to what we just saw this month. Is the Colonial Pipeline ransomware attack a distinctly different wake-up call than we've seen in the thousands of ransomware attacks that have happened over the past several years?
Well, I think this is a different type of ransomware attack in that the previous attacks on mostly on city governments, on educational institutions, on some limited small municipalities haven't garnered the attention that a ransomware attack that disabled the operation of a significant critical infrastructure, what we like to call a national critical function, that happened with this ransomware attack. So it really did bring this to a higher level of attention and garnered the kind of public scrutiny that hopefully will push further change.
But I do understand, though, that you've said that we being the United States, got off easy this time with how the colonial attack unfolded.
Oh, for certain. There are a lot of other national critical functions or national critical infrastructures that could cause significantly more damage. Even in the pipeline industry, an attack on, say, a natural gas pipeline that limited its flow from the eastern seaboard would have dramatically more impact. As you may know, natural gas provides about 40% of the electrical power production in our country. So ceasing natural gas pipeline operations for 7 to 10 days would have a dramatic impact on our economic security, our national security, and even the public safety and health security of our citizens.
So we're going to talk in a lot more detail about what happened with the Colonial attack a bit later in the show. But I do want to ask you, based on what we know so far, do we know if it was the actual ransomware attack that led to the shutdown of the fuel pipeline, or if that was sort of a knock-on effect from what the actual target of the attack?
So I think the ransomware attack was on the business operations of Colonial, of the company. However, the company did practice good governance in the idea that they first have to shut down their operation system to ensure that there wasn't malware in that system and that it could operate properly. So it is a natural response to this, the initial part of the attack, for the operations to have secured. Now, why it stayed secured may have to do with what's the interconnectivity between the business operations in the company and the physical operations, whether the simple things like just even the accounting and billing for the distribution of the automated distribution of the refined fuel could cause them to not bring it online until they've decrypted the ransomware or reloaded a backup system that would allow them to do it. Much like a plane crash where it may start with, you know, a material problem, you know, the response of the pilot will sometimes contribute as well. I think you can see the same kind of knock-on effects, as you said, in this incident.
Okay. So like I said, later in the show, we're going to hear more from reporters who've been following in detail what happened with the Colonial Pipeline. But Mark Montgomery, let's take a step back here. You heard me quote that number at the top of the show, that some 85% of the nation's critical infrastructure is owned by the private sector. If you were to give it a grade overall on how vulnerable it is to cyber attack, what grade would you give it?
Well, first, I would say it's extremely inconsistent, but generally poor. And what I mean by that is the federal government tends to look at the national critical infrastructure, which, as you said, is 85% privately or owned and operated. We look at it as 16 critical infrastructures: financial services, electrical generation and production, water and wastewater services, telecommunications, pipelines, you know, on and on. It is broadly inconsistent. And a good example is financial services, where some of our largest banks have extremely high levels of cybersecurity investment. You know, they're banks with more than $500 million a year in annual cybersecurity budgets, and they run operations centers that would make a military 3 or 4 star envious. So those are high levels. Then you have other levels like our water wastewater systems, where there's really no limited investment in cybersecurity. We saw in the pipeline systems that were incredibly vulnerable. So it's an inconsistent grade, but generally poor.
Generally poor. I mean, so that's a very, very wide spectrum. You just described some banks that spend $500 million a year on cybersecurity alone at one end, and then virtually non-existent cybersecurity for other critical infrastructure at the other end. So, you know, in 2012, when Republicans blocked that bipartisan bill, by the way, in the Senate, you heard me mention that the U.S. Chamber of Commerce had offered its criticism of the bill, its vehement criticism of the bill, saying that it's, you know, against too much government interference with the free market. I mean, what is really the core set of reasons why these private infrastructure, these critical infrastructure companies in the private sector have not invested more in cybersecurity?
So I think part of it is a failure to perceive that they were threatened. And that's what's changed dramatically, both as nation states have done more and more. We see that in SolarWinds, in the Microsoft Exchange hack, and as criminal and non-state actors have done more and more actions. And we see that in the ransomware, which has grown almost 400% year over year since 2019.
400%. And their technological ability to institute or launch these attacks has also gotten dramatically better.
Exactly. In fact, if I could describe the risk like this, the availability and complexity of tools that the adversary has increased exponentially. That increases risk exponentially. The interconnectivity of our systems, which we value, which gives us decreased costs and increased economic mobility, that's increased exponentially. So those are two big risk drivers increasing exponentially. Yet our investment in cybersecurity has been at best linear. So that's the risk mitigator. So when your risk drivers are exponential and your risk mitigators are linear, you're introducing a lot of risk that takes significant investment in cybersecurity to resolve.
I mean, that's a mountainous gap that you're describing, literally a mountainous gap between mitigation and liability there. It's huge. Now, listen, we've got about a minute before the break here, Mark. Previously in your career, you served as the former policy director for the Senate Armed Services Committee under the then leadership of Senator John McCain, who was famously very hawkish about U.S. national security. He was a leader on this. Were you surprised that he led the Republican resistance to that 2012 cybersecurity bill? I mean, you called it a major lost opportunity.
So I'd say two things. One, there's the Chamber of Commerce's opposition, which I think was based on a perceived lack of vulnerability, which the chamber no longer sees, I think, as you fast forward 8 years. Senator McCain was attempting to get some amendments into that bill that Jack Reed wasn't comfortable putting in for whatever reason. So I think there's probably more to the kind of partisan politics that are involved in that. I will say one thing. Senator McCain is the one who set up our commission, though, in 2019 to really tackle this problem and will, in the end, I think historically be seen as someone who addressed these critical infrastructure issues.
Well, Mark Montgomery, senior advisor to the Cyberspace Solarium Commission. It's that bipartisan intergovernmental body. We'll have more from Mark when we come back. We are talking this hour about the critical vulnerability of the nation's critical infrastructure to cyber attack. We'll be back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken? A podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit. Period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we are talking about how vulnerable the nation's critical infrastructure is to cyber attack and what it's going to take to strengthen or harden that infrastructure to protect it from attack. Of course, this conversation comes in the wake of the ransomware attack on Colonial Pipeline, and the significance of that attack and the disruption that it caused specifically to the southeastern United States rose to the level of the White House. Here's President Biden last week trying to calm the public, asking them not to hoard gasoline and also to be patient.
This morning, Colonial reported that fuel is beginning to flow to a majority of the markets that they service, and they should be reaching full operational capacity as we speak, as I speak to you right now. That is good news. But I want to be clear. will not feel the effects at the pump immediately. This is not like flicking on a light switch. This pipeline is 5,500 miles long.
President Biden also talked about who was behind the attack.
We do not believe, I emphasize, we do not believe the Russian government was involved in this attack. But we do have strong reason to believe that the criminals who did the attack are living in Russia. That's where it came from. We're from Russia. We have been in direct communications with Moscow about the imperative for responsible countries to take decisive action against these ransomware networks.
I'm joined today by Mark Montgomery. He's senior advisor to Cyberspace Solarium Commission, to the Cyberspace Solarium Commission. That's a bipartisan governmental body created in 2019 to develop a strategic approach to defense against cyber attacks in the United States. And Mark, talk about the significance of the president of the United States commenting multiple times on what happened with Colonial Pipeline. Have we seen that before?
Not in this kind of detail about a cybersecurity attack on a critical infrastructure. And I think this will, in the end, be very helpful to kind of addressing the difficult solutions that we're going to need to put forward over the next year to protect our critical infrastructure. Having the president prioritize this issue, discuss it here. Also at this press conference, he discussed the need to confirm a national cyber director and a new director for the Cybersecurity Infrastructure Security Agency. I think presidential leadership on this issue is critical.
What do you make of the fact that Biden went to pains to say, we have strong reason to believe the group that did this is in Russia, but not the Russian government?
Well, I think this probably helps frame what his response will be, what the government's response will be to the adversary. Because in the end, and potentially already by now, the tools of the U.S. government, whether in the intelligence community or in the military, should be conducting some sort of operations to create friction or disrupt the capability of DarkSide or other ransomware as a service providers inside Russia. And I must say that it's a fine line to say that it's not the Russian government, but it's an organization that effectively the Russian government tacitly supports and encourages by taking no action against them when they clearly violate criminal statutes internationally.
So then are there diplomatic tools that can be used here in response?
Sure. I think when you look at how the government responds to this, a little bit's in the intelligence community and in a military cyber capability response, but a lot of it has to reside in the State Department's actions and in Treasury Department actions and in law enforcement actions. So really it's about sanctions. It's about indictments, and it's about creating friction for these companies and the authoritarian states that support them as they continue to try to operate in cyberspace.
Hmm. Okay, so that's one sort of branch of things that can be done here diplomatically, but obviously the focus has to be on what can be done policy-wise and technologically here in the United States. So, I mean, you're with the Cyberspace Solarium Commission, Mark. I mean, where would you start to harden and protect our critical infrastructure?
Well, the first thing I'd say is, you know, we kind of look at this challenge as a three-legged stool. The first is technology. We have to have better investment in the cybersecurity defenses of our critical infrastructure. That begins with the companies themselves. They have to acknowledge that we have both threats from criminals, such as ransomware, but also from nation states, depending on which industry you're in, and that you have to make the investments in that. And look, a lot of companies like Colonial have benefited from the automation that this interconnectivity brings. There's much less workers on the station operating valves and starting and stopping pumps. But the question is, are those companies taking those significant savings and making the appropriate, much smaller investments in cybersecurity? And the answer in a lot of cases has been no. So first and foremost, you have to invest in the technology. The second leg of the stool is processes. You have to put in the policies, whether it's the information sharing with the government, whether it's reporting incidents, it's how you run your business, cyber hygiene to make yourself less vulnerable. But the processes, and the third one's the people. And this is one that gets almost no attention. But the reality is, both inside the government and inside the broader national and infrastructure, we're short about 33% of cybersecurity experts. So in the United States, that's about 350,000. In the U.S. government, it's about 35,000. That is a significant shortfall. So we have to make the investments in training and education programs that entices middle school and high school kids into the cybersecurity environment, and then entices, you know, provides a way to recruit from colleges into the federal government. So technology, processes, people, you have to tackle all three. And frequently, you only hear about one or two in a legislative proposal or executive branch action.
Okay, so we're going to come back to that three-legged stool here in just a few minutes to find out practically how we could make some meaningful advances on those technology, processes, and people. But Mark, stand by here for just a second, because joining us now is Nicole Perlroth. She covers cybersecurity and digital espionage for The New York Times. And her new book is called This Is How They Tell Me the World Ends, The Cyber Weapons Arms Race. We have an excerpt of that at onpointradio.org. Nicole, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much for having me, Meghna.
So first of all, tell us a little bit more about what you've discovered, or what we should know about how this ransomware attack first happened to Colonial Pipeline. I mean, do we know what the door is, the cyber door that the ransomware attackers got through?
We do not. You know, they have been a little bit of a black box on this. And I don't know if they even know how the ransomware came in. You know, we always talk about patient zero. We don't know who patient zero was in this attack, but I would not be surprised if it ended up being some kind of spear phishing incident where they, you know, sent someone a link or attachment, or got them to enter their login credentials somewhere, or tested dumb passwords across their employees' login credentials. So we still don't know, but what we do know is that, you know, the ransomware hit their IT systems, and as a precautionary measure, they went ahead and shut down the pipeline, either because they didn't have confidence in the separation between their IT systems and the pipeline, or we're hearing that they also wanted to be able to do billing, and they couldn't do billing. They couldn't charge for gas or track how much gas was flowing out of the pipeline with their billing system shut down. And so they took that preemptive step of shutting down their operation. And unfortunately, you know, what we have here is a new playbook for any adversary that would like to cause significant disruption or uncertainty to the United States with a degree of plausible deniability.
So that is so important to understand, Nicole, because what you're saying is, in part, the pipeline might have been shut down because Colonial didn't want to give away gas for free while they were trying to deal with this problem. That's challenging in and of itself, but also because they weren't confident that the attack could spread literally to the pipeline itself. Both things are extremely worrying. But for the fact that an attack does not even actually have to have an impact directly on the pipes and valves themselves and can cause this level of disruption, what could happen if a ransomware attack did indeed go to take that next step and start turning valves on and off, for example?
Yeah, I mean, it's a really disturbing case, because I think continually in cyber, especially for the last 10 years, we've really underestimated what adversaries can do with really basic means. And in this case, it was a ransomware group that was just coming for their IT systems. And, you know, we don't think that they had any intention of shutting the operation down. But we have seen attacks, usually from Russia, over the last 5 years, where Russia got into a petrochemical plant in Saudi Arabia and took it as far as dismantling the safety locks, which are the very last thing from staving off some kind of explosion. Fortunately, thank God, in the process, They basically triggered a shutdown of the whole plant. So things actually functioned the way that they should. And we were able to learn about it. But why were they inside a Saudi petrochemical plant trying to shut off the safety locks? Well, I think what they were doing is they were testing out their capabilities for some future hybrid warfare situation. Huh. And for now, we don't see Russia really having the impetus to use those capabilities here in the United States. But what just happened with this ransomware group, you know, holding this IT system hostage, forcing the company to shut off operations, offers them a little bit of a more clever playbook in that so long as these attacks keep coming from ransomware and having similar impacts, you know, there's a playbook there.
Now, as you've been reminding us in your reporting, Nicole, I mean, this really was a major crisis. Emergency meetings in the White House. We talked about that fuel hoarding that people did, jump in gas prices. Even, you know, we played that tape at the top of the show, airlines having to make fuel stops on what would usually be a long haul flight. But do we know for sure whether or not Colonial Pipeline paid the ransom or any ransom that was being demanded of it?
Yes, we do know that they paid the ransom. There are Bitcoin transactions that are public that you can see for the exact amount that I've heard they paid the ransom, which was something nearing $5 million over the weekend. Although I spoke with one person who was involved in the transaction on Monday that said that, you know, by Monday, Colonial was interacting with a bank to try and pay back whoever had facilitated that payment on that Bitcoin payment on their behalf. So, yes, you know, I have confirmed that they paid the ransom. But, you know, what's interesting here is that they really blocked the U.S. government and the White House from engaging with them until after they had made that payment, probably because they wanted to bury it. But over and over again, we see companies quietly pay these ransoms because the cost to pay off the ransom is still cheaper than the cost of downtime and rebuilding all of their systems from scratch.
Okay, so Mark Montgomery, respond to what Nicole is saying. My ears prick up a mile high when I hear that a company that is part of the critical infrastructure of the United States of America and is doing vast amounts of business as part of that critical infrastructure, when they are the subject of an attack, as Nicole's saying, are not talking with the federal government, are even blocking information sharing. You talked about process and information sharing being a key part of the long-term solution here. Why are companies allowed to not talk to the federal government in the midst of a crisis?
Well, first, I share your frustration, Magna, and Nicole's description is spot on. And I will tell you that there's a great deal of frustration both within the executive branch and in Congress over this failure to have fulsome and comprehensive incident reporting. I think the solution is going to be one of the proposals we had in the Cyberspace Steering Commission, which is the idea that you have to identify your national critical functions. And I think Colonial would be a national critical function. And those national critical functions then have to have a compact with the federal government. And that compact is the idea that you'll get some benefits from the government, you know, the government, and then you'll provide some burdens to the government. The idea of the burden, one of the first ones would be you have to report any incident, and not in, you know, 72 days or 72 hours, but in, you know, within 72 minutes, you know, in a very timely way, report to the government that an incident's happened. And the second part of that burden on the critical infrastructure companies is that they maintain a reasonable standard of care, that they have a level of cybersecurity, and whether it's through existing regulations such as we have in the telecommunications and financial services industry or new ones that are created, we're going to need to have that kind of burden. Now, the good news is the companies will receive a benefit. You know, if they do this, they'll get improved intelligence sharing, improved access to adversaries, criminal signal and criminal cyber signals and attack methods. And finally, they could get some kind of liability protection, which is one of the things these companies worry about. But you have to have that compact, and we don't have it right now. And this situation really called it out, where Nicole is exactly correct. Colonial did the absolute minimum amount of interaction with the federal government that they could get away with the intent of not being directed what to do and not letting the government get involved in their business operations.
Mm. Nicole, did you want to add to that?
No, I think that's right. That's what I've been getting in my reporting, that essentially, you know, one person told me that they told the government to go pound sand. So yeah, you know, we need to fix this. And I think Mark's right. And there was some progress in this latest executive order that does offer some incentives that Mark just outlined for information sharing, but also I think importantly offer some sticks to companies that, you know, are not meeting a bare standard of cybersecurity. You know, I think they did the most that they could do in an executive order, which was say, you know, any company that wants to do business with the federal government will have to meet these cybersecurity standards, and we will let you even self-certify that you meet those standards. We won't make you go walk through a ton of red tape. You can self-certify. But if we find out that you lack that bare minimum of cybersecurity, you can never do business with the federal government. And in so many cases of critical infrastructure operators, that would make them not commercially viable. So I think that was an important stick built in.
It does seem like an important one because, you know, the leverage of the federal government's buying power is quite a powerful tool. But we're also talking about critical infrastructure across the entire United States. So I'm wondering if it's enough of a first stick. We'll talk about that when we come back. So Nicole Perlroth and Mark Montgomery, stand by. We are learning about just how vulnerable the nation's critical infrastructure is, 85% of which is held and operated by private companies. We'll have a lot more when we come back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we are talking about the true depth of vulnerability to the nation's critical infrastructure, 85% of which is held by private companies. And we're trying to learn what can be done to harden and strengthen that critical infrastructure so it can resist what could be in the future, we hope not, but could be crippling attacks on the United States. I'm joined today by Nicole Perlroth. She covers cybersecurity for The New York Times and author of the book, This Is How They Tell Me the World Ends, The Cyber Weapons Arms Race. Mark Montgomery also joins us as well. He's senior advisor to the Cyberspace Solarium Commission. That's a bipartisan governmental body created in 2019 that's developing a strategic approach to defense against cyber attacks in the United States. Now, let's listen to a moment to what former director of the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Agency, Chris Krebs, said on Sunday. He was on CBS's Face the Nation when he talked about private sector critical infrastructure companies and what they need to learn from the attack on Colonial Pipeline.
One of the key things I took away from the last week is that business executives have to stop looking at cybersecurity as a technical risk issue. And it truly is a business risk. I mean, we're talking resilience of the national economy. We've got to do a better job in terms of closing out vulnerabilities and making our systems and our operations more resilient.
It's Chris Krebs on Face the Nation this weekend. I would say that it's more than a business risk. It's a national security risk and a human risk here in the United States. But joining us now with more is Kirsten Todd, Managing Director of the Cyber Readiness Institute and Executive Director of former President Obama's Bipartisan Commission on Enhancing National Cybersecurity. Kirsten, welcome to On Point.
Thanks so much, Meghna. Great to be with you.
So you heard Krebs there talking about how business leaders look at cybersecurity risk. I wonder if you could tell us the story of your firsthand experience of this back in 2013 when I believe a Fortune 100 company, so one of the 100 biggest companies in the United States, asked you to come in to do some cybersecurity analysis.
Well, it goes to this recognition and how quickly this issue has accelerated. But early on, the recognition that, you know, cybersecurity and physical security are inextricably linked. And the learning curve, the steep learning curve that a lot of businesses were having in recognizing how their cyber infrastructure was impacting their physical infrastructure. And so I was brought in to work with an infrastructure company. But even before I was brought in, there was an individual who was doing resilience, business resilience for the company that was very much focused on physical safety precautions. And he wanted to look at the impact of cyber in how they were managing the physical piece. And he got a lot of pushback from his senior leadership on the fact that cyber was really an IT issue at the time, and that when you're talking about the security of the company and the viability of the company, this was not something that they wanted to bring to the board, to the senior leadership. And ultimately, this person was able to make the case for it. And we did a tabletop exercise of an incident where the cyber issue impacted the physical safety. Sort of going to what Nicole was talking about with Colonial Pipeline, just how you have this issue. But this was even before kind of that case was being made. And then a few months later, actually, that same incident happened to the company. And so that person who had put forth, you know, certainly had a good trajectory because he was recognized as somebody that could see that this was becoming more of an issue. But what's stark to me and striking is that, you know, we're in 2021. And, you know, Nicole laid this out very clearly. And this idea that we have to recognize that business operations, our data centers, they do have an impact on the physical piece if they're not being firewalled. And this is one of the key pieces. I was talking to a board member of an infrastructure company just last week who was saying that he is going in constantly asking if the IT and the OT are separated or firewalled. And what that means is essentially the data center of a company where all of the data comes through is separated from how that company is executing its infrastructure mission. And there oftentimes is an assumption that that's happening, but we fail right now to truly recognize that the data that's going into the center is actually inputting into the operational piece in a way that's creating that vulnerability. And I think it calls into question all of the questions that you've been raising about how to secure and make our infrastructure more resilient.
So this 2013 story is fascinating to me because at the time, if I understand correctly, this company didn't really even have basic cybersecurity measures. And as you point out, 3 months later, the fictional attack you had done a tabletop exercise on literally happened. So let me ask you, were minds changed after that first attack?
Well, they were. I mean, it was one of the greatest lessons in sort of marketing for the person that had put forth this, because he was trying to build out a division within his company to really look at business resilience. And the greatest naysayer in the company ended up being his greatest supporter for recognizing that piece. And I think an important nuance, though, is that the company did have cybersecurity protocols in place, but they were seeing them as limited to essentially the IT piece and not recognizing the potential impact it could have on the operations of the company itself.
Okay, so you heard Mark earlier say that's perhaps exactly that is one of the reasons why this Colonial Pipeline attack could be a turning point here, because it's proving how essential the beefing up or hardening cyber is for these companies. Would you agree? Will it be easier now? Knock on wood, to get, you know, legislation passed or regulations passed, or companies more amenable to that now?
Well, it's hard to assess the impact. We've talked often about, you know, what's the cyber event that's going to change minds. And every time there is one that we think is significant, it doesn't quite do the job. But I'll tell you what's been unique about this particular event We saw the president of the United States have a press conference on a cybersecurity issue as it was happening. That was notable. That it certainly was rising to the surface. At the same time, we saw the most comprehensive executive order, most prescriptive executive order on cybersecurity that we've ever seen. But the other piece was we saw as an individual, I live in the Commonwealth of Virginia, and in a matter of days, we heard about how a company wasn't securing its data in a very cybersecurity type language, not patching or wherever the weak authentication was that created the access. And that translated in record time to people waiting in line to get gas. Mm-hmm. And, there was that reminder for those of us that, were young at the time, but could remember what happened to President Carter when there were long lines at the gas station. There's that very visual impact. And we haven't actually had that in cybersecurity in that direct way. And, I'm an optimist by nature. I'm reluctant to say this is the turning point or this is the game changer, but certainly that connection is one of the more direct connections that we've seen impacting Americans in a very real way.
Okay, so Mark, let me turn to you on that. Would you agree with that? And could that pave the way for actual legislation, possibly even in the gridlocked Congress that we have now?
So I do think that can happen, and I would say that cybersecurity still is a reasonably nonpartisan issue, and the proof for me in that is that last year we were able to push through about 27 provisions in the National Defense Authorization Act that will contribute to a more secure and cyber environment. And those include things like establishing a national cyber director, strengthening CISA, Chris Krebs's former organization, and establishing sector risk management agencies. Now, that hasn't kicked in yet, but what that would do is say to the Transportation Security Agency, who is responsible for working with companies like Colonial, that they have more accountability and responsibility in that. So I think we were able to do some things last year. The really hard ones, like that compact I talked about between the national critical functions and the government, we could not pass. I do think we're going to have a greater opportunity to pass those in this year's legislative cycle, building both on the executive order, which is really about solar winds, but as Kirsten properly pointed out, has some positive impact on the critical infrastructure problem we had with Colonial. But building on that executive order and then just really getting some clean legislative wins is very possible, and I expect to see some success this summer.
Okay, so Nicole, a little earlier you talked about that EO, and you described that there were like some sticks in there, but are those sticks enough? I wonder if sometimes in order to really move the private sector, perhaps we've seen how effective lawsuits even can be. I mean, I say that with all seriousness. Do you think lawsuits to Colonial might actually be again an example of a stick that could actually lead to better cybersecurity down the line?
I hope actually that we might see some lawsuits here, because especially if it comes down to unpatched software. I mean, this is a company that was responsible for transporting almost half of the gas and jet fuel for the East Coast. And we don't think or know whether this is how the ransomware got in. But after the fact, after we learned they'd been held up by ransomware, we found out that they had not yet patched for the Microsoft vulnerability, the Microsoft Exchange System vulnerability that we saw being exploited by China just the other week or month. So that's negligence. That is negligence. And I do think that at this point, companies for so long have looked at cybersecurity as something that there's no return on investment for. It's not a profit center. But I think now they see this is a real money loser. I mean, the cost of putting something in that would have been a gateway, we call it like a unidirectional gateway, but it's basically an advanced firewall between their OT systems and their IT systems, would have been significantly cheaper than even one day of downtime. But apparently they didn't have that. And that would have actually allowed them to continue billing customers. And there is a solution out there called Waterfall. I don't want to do their marketing for them. But there are a lot of pipeline operators in the United States that use that advanced firewall and would not have been impacted in the same way. So I think it is totally fair to ask why Colonial Pipeline didn't have that critical piece in place. And how do we get companies to look at this risk more seriously? I think this is a great example. We talk so much about the threat from Iran or North Korea or Russia or China, but here was just a cyber criminal ransomware group. You know, maybe one day we'll learn that they did have deeper connections to the Russian state, but for now we believe that they were just a cyber criminal gang that basically bumbled into the IT system of this major pipeline operator that then forced them to turn off their own systems and really, you know, at a loss that they really wasn't a guarantee. They could have staved this off.
Yeah. So Kirsten Todd, a little earlier, Mark actually offered us this three-pronged solution, this framework to think about how to increase cybersecurity in our critical infrastructure. He talked about, you know, investing in technology, processes. We were discussing information sharing and beefing up information sharing requirements amongst other processes, and investing in people, like getting more people to be cybersecurity experts, both in the government and in the private sector. It's a really powerful framework. But I wonder if we're missing a piece of it. And that is, as we've discussed here over and over again, it seems as if that 85% of critical infrastructure that's held by private sector companies, they, by virtue of being companies, have what I'll call a balance sheet perspective on this, right? I mean, it is about costs and profits and losses. But they are providing services. Their businesses are for public goods. I mean, we're talking about electricity. We're talking about fuel. We're talking about, Mark talked about natural gas powering the country. We're talking about water. I mean, is that part of the problem here, that we just don't even have the same the lenses on what this infrastructure actually means? Because I'm wondering, and I promise there's a question at the end of this, Kirsten, but I'm wondering if that's preventing us from really taking big, meaningful next steps. A couple of years ago, I spoke with Joel Brenner, who I'm sure you know, former Inspector General at the NSA, and he had written up this report suggesting, you know, big solutions, like a lot of these systems should be even like fully removed from the public internet entirely. Talk about a firewall there, but I don't see any possibility of something like that on the horizon, Kirsten.
So you've covered a lot of important data. So first of all, what Mark is talking about, the people, processes, and technology as a framework, I absolutely believe in. And it's that idea that you've got to really focus on human behavior from a cybersecurity perspective, and then have the processes that facilitate that behavior to do well, and then the technologies to do that. And so that is one piece for how businesses should operate and how we truly should operate as a culture, because we are now, cybersecurity is a part of all of our lives. So we cannot separate ourselves out of it. And I can talk through, I think there are a lot of analogies to safety and security. We've heard the seatbelt analogy and bicycle helmets, all these things that we need to be doing. But separate and distinct is what you're talking about as far as the role of critical infrastructure. And, you know, Mark touched on this as he's talking through the compact with the national critical infrastructures in the U.S. government, because we are in a place where, the statistic that we hear, 85% of our critical infrastructure owned and operated by the private sector. And as long as that is the case, without any oversight or management of true form across all infrastructure, we have to recognize that the market incentives are very much about economic profit. And right now we're prioritizing in our market, we'll always prioritize profit over security. And you don't have to look too far back than SolarWinds to learn that, you know, one of the issues with SolarWinds was that it had two venture firms that were backing it that were known for being very focused on cost cutting. And we learned that SolarWinds was maintaining its software in Eastern Europe for cost cutting measures. This isn't, you know, we shouldn't be doing anything abroad when it comes to software. It's very specifically, we know that they were doing that to cut costs. So if the investors and the companies themselves are always going to prioritize profit over security, then we have, you know, negative market incentives. And to your point, that is absolutely where we have to look at how government and industry can truly work together to give ourselves a more resilient infrastructure.
Well, Kirsten Todd, Managing Director of the Cyber Readiness Institute, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Meghna.
And Mark Montgomery, Senior Advisor to the Cyberspace Solarium Commission. Mark, it was tremendous to have you. Thank you so very much.
Thanks for having me, Meghna.
And Nicole Perl-Roth, she covers cybersecurity for The New York Times, author of the new book, This Is How They Tell Me the World Ends, The Cyber Weapons Arms Race. We have an excerpt of it at onpointradio.org. Nicole, thank you so much for your incredible reporting.
Thank you so much for drawing awareness to these issues. It's really important. Thank you, Meghna.
This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices. And they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons. And there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.